Probably the most hated man in the New York State prison service was Asa L.J. Granger, head keeper of Clinton Prison, at Dannemora. He had effectively quelled the prison riot of July 22, 1929. Upon this Christmas Day, of 1930, in the Champlain Valley Hospital, Plattsburgh, N.Y., Granger was operated upon for appendicitis. 2 days later he died. About this time, Harry M. Kaiser, the warden of Clinton Prison, was suffering from what was said to be high blood pressure. He died, 3 months later, New York Herald Tribune, March 24, 1931. The London newspapers of March, 1926, told of fires that had simultaneously broken out in several parts of Closes Hall, the residence of Captain B. Heaton, near Clitheroe, Lancashire. The fires were in the woodwork under the roof, and were believed to have been caused by sparks from the kitchen stove. These fires were in places that were inaccessible to any ordinary incendiary. To get to them, the firemen had to chop holes in the roof. Nothing was said of previous fires here. Maybe it is strange that sparks from a kitchen stove should simultaneously ignite remote parts of a house, distances apart. A fire in somebody's house did not much interest me, but then I read of a succession of similars. In 3 months, there had been 10 other mansion fires. Scotland Yard recently made arrangements for all details of mansion fires to be sent to them, in order that the circumstances might be collated, and the probable cause of the outbreaks discovered. April 2, 1926 Ashley Moor, a mansion near Leominster, destroyed by fire. Somebody, or something, was burning mansions. How it was done was the mystery. There was a scare, and probably these houses were more than ordinarily guarded, but so well protected are they, ordinarily, that some extraordinary means of entrance is suggested. In no report was it said that there was any evidence of how an incendiary got into a house. No theft was reported. 4 months, every now and then there was a mansion fire. Presumably the detectives of Scotland Yard were busily collating. The London newspapers, of November 6, told of the 30th mansion fire in about 10 months. There were flaming mansions, and there were flaming utterances, in England. Sometimes I am a collector of data, and only a collector, and am likely to be gross and miserly, piling up notes, pleased with merely numerically adding to my stores. Other times I have joys, when unexpectedly coming upon an outrageous story that may not be altogether a lie, or upon a macabre little thing that may make some reviewer of my more or less good works mad. But always there is present a feeling of unexplained relations of events that I note, and it is this far away, haunting, or often taunting, awareness, or suspicion, that keeps me piling on. Or, in a feeling of relatability of seemingly most incongruous occurrences that nevertheless may be correlated into the service of one general theme, I am like a primitive farmer, who conceives that a zebra and a cow may be hitched together to draw his plow. But isn't there something common about zebras and cows? An ostrich and a hyena. Then the concept of a pageantry, the ransack of the jungles for creatures of the widest unlikeness to draw his plow, and former wild clatters of hoofs and patters of paws are the tramp of a song. Here come the animals, two by two. Or John Doughty, three abreast with the dead men of a Harlem park, pulling on my theme, followed by the 45 schoolgirls of Derby and the fish dealer's housemaid, with her arms full of sponges and Turkish towels, followed by burning beds, most suggestively associated with her, but in no way that any conventional thinker can explain. Or the mansion fires in England, in the year 1926, and, in a minor hitch-up, I feel the relatability of two scenes. In Hyde Park, London, an orator shouts, "What we want is no king and no law. How we'll get it will be, not with ballots, but with bullets." Far away in Gloucestershire, a house that dates back to Elizabethan times unaccountably bursts into flames. 5. "Good morning," said the dog. He disappeared in a thin, greenish vapor. I have this record, upon newspaper authority. It can't be said, and therefore will be said, that I have a marvelous credulity for newspaper yarns. but I am so obviously offering everything in this book, as fiction. That is, if there is fiction. But this book is fiction in the sense that Pickwick Papers, and the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and Uncle Tom's Cabin, Newton's Principia, Darwin's Origin of Species, Genesis, Gulliver's Travels, and Mathematical Theorems, and every history of the United States, and all other histories, are fictions. A library myth that irritates me most is the classification of books under fiction and non-fiction. And yet there is something about the yarns that were told by Dickens that sets them apart, as it were, from the yarns that were told by Euclid. There is much in Dickens' Grote's Queries that has the correspondence with experience that is called truth, whereas such Euclidean characters as Mathematical Points are the vacancies that might be expected from a mind that had had scarcely any experience. That dog story is axiomatic. It must be taken on faith. And, even though with effects that sometimes are not much admired, I ask questions. It was told in the New York World, July 29, 1908. Many petty robberies, in the neighborhood of Lincoln Avenue, Pittsburgh detectives detailed to catch the thief. Early in the morning of July 26, a big, black dog sauntered past them. "Good morning," said the dog. He disappeared in a thin, greenish vapor. There will be readers who will want to know what I mean by turning down this story, while accepting so many others in this book. It is because I never write about marvels. The wonderful, or the never before heard of, I leave to whimsical, or radical, fellows. All books written by me are of quite ordinary occurrences. If, say sometime in the year 1847, a New Orleans newspaper told of a cat, who said, "Well, is it warm enough for you?" and instantly disappeared sulphurously, as should everybody who says that, and, if I had a clipping, dated sometime in the year 1930, telling of a mouse, who squeaked, "I was along this way, and thought I'd drop in," and vanished along a trail of purple sparklets, and something similar from the St. Helena Guardian, August 17, 1905, and something like that from the Madras Mail, year 1879, I'd consider the story of the polite dog no marvel, and I'd admit him to our fold. But it is not that I take numerous repetitions, as a standard for admission. The fellow who found the pearl in the oyster stew, the old fiddle that turned out to be a Stradivarius, the ring that was lost in a lake, and then what was found when a fish was caught. But these often repeated yarns are conventional yarns. And almost all liars are conventionalists. The one quality that the lower animals have not in common with human beings is creative imagination. Neither a man, nor a dog, nor an oyster ever has had any. Of course there is another view, by which is seen that there is in everything a touch of creativeness. I cannot say that truth is stranger than fiction, because I have never had acquaintance with either. Though I have classed myself with some noted fictionists, I have to accept that the absolute fictionist never has existed. There is a fictional coloration to everybody's account of an actual occurrence, and there is at least the lurk somewhere of what is called the actual in everybody's yarn. There is the hyphenated state of truth fiction. Out of dozens of reported pearls in stews, most likely there have been instances, most likely once upon a time an old fiddle did turn out to be a Stradivarius, and it could be that once upon a time somebody did get a ring back fishwise. But when I come upon the unconventional repeating, in times and places far apart, I feel even though I have no absolute standards to judge by that I am outside the field of ordinary liars. Even in the matter of the talking dog, I think that the writer probably had something to base upon. Perhaps he had heard of talking dogs. It is not that I think it impossible that detectives could meet a dog, who would say, "Good morning." That's no marvel. It is good morning, and disappearing in the thin, greenish vapor that I am making such a time about. In the New York Herald Tribune, February 21, 1928, there was an account of a French bulldog, owned by Mrs. Mabel Robinson, of Bangor, Maine. He could distinctly say, "Hello." Mrs. J. Stewart Tompkins, 101 West 85th Street, New York, read of this animal, and called up the Herald Tribune, telling of her dog, a Great Dane, who was at least equally accomplished. A reporter went to interview the dog, and handed him a piece of candy. "Thank you," said the dog. In the city of Northampton, England, see Lloyd's Weekly News, London, March 2, 1912. A detective chased a burglar, who had entered a hardware store. The burglar got away. The detective went back, and got into the store. There were objects hanging on hooks, overhead. By coincidence, just as the detective passed under one of them, it fell. It was a scythe blade. It cut off his ear. Now I am upon familiar ground, there are suggestions in this story that correlate with suggestions in other stories. A bank in Blackpool was robbed, in broad daylight, on Saturday, in mysterious circumstances, so says the London Daily Telegraph, August 7, 1926. It was one of the largest establishments in town, the Blackpool branch of the Midland Bank. At noon, Saturday, while the doors were closing, an official of the Corporation Tramways Department went into the building, with a bag, which contained £800, in treasury notes. In the presence of about 25 customers, he placed the bag upon a counter. Then the doorman unlocked the front door for him to go out, and then return with another amount of money, in silver, from a motor van. The bag had vanished from the counter. It was a large, leather bag. Nobody could, without making himself conspicuous, try to conceal it. Nobody wearing a maternity cloak was reported.